Bible says he knew what was in man. He learned obedience by the things which he suffered. I don't think that means he had to learn to obey, but he learned what obedience costs people in the flesh. He learned that. He learned how difficult it is to live these heavenly principles in flesh. Even a flesh that hasn't sinned, how limited flesh can be and how difficult it is. So he understood all of that, but he was an idealist. He was also a realist. I remember Peter Marshall saying, you can be both, and he used the oyster as an example. He said the oyster gets a little piece of sand in its shell, and it pierces, and there's blood, and there's pain, and the oyster doesn't rebel. The oyster just starts to deposit a milky quartz substance on that quartz and finally produces something for which divers will risk their lives to secure, a pearl. And I always liked the way he described the pearl. Wondrous beauty wrapped around trouble. And that's a picture I have, that when there's trouble in the congregation, that's the opportunity for us to show wondrous beauty wrapped around trouble. The trouble itself should produce an oyster. Is that too lofty, Brother Dan? Anyway, let me start with an illustration from our community. We live 25 miles approximately from the Gettysburg battlefield. That was the largest battle ever fought on American soil. It was a horrible battle. It's fought on July the 1st through the 3rd, extremely hot weather, 1863. That was the battle that should have ended the Civil War. It should have ended right there. One third of the Southern troops were either killed or wounded in that battle. They simply would not have had enough troops to continue. And in fact, there were 51,000 casualties in that battle. I just can't imagine. In 3 days in the hot sun, here are these 51,000 casualties. Well, in the middle of that, Lincoln realized how crucial this battle was. So he sent one frantic telegram after another to General George Meade saying, do not let the Confederate army escape. Destroy the Southern army. The whole army was there. And I remember hearing older people talk about the wagons that went down through our valley with these wounded men with blood dripping out of the wagons and men moaning and groaning as they retreated to the south. But that was not supposed to happen. Meade was supposed to destroy that army, and he didn't. He disobeyed every telegram that the president sent. And after the war, there was a lot of insistence that General Meade be court-martialed and disgracefully discharged from the army. But Lincoln gave him an honorable discharge. And he said this. He said, I was not at Gettysburg during those three horrible days. If I had been there, I may not have had the heart to destroy a wounded army. So he forgave Meade. Somebody has said Lincoln had a magnanimous heart. That means huge. Now, true, he was fighting a war, and we're only drawing one little illustration from this battle, but he was known to have a real heart wherever he was able to demonstrate that. So Jesus knew that he had set lofty ideals. He knew he had described a different kind of person, a person free from anger, a person free from lust, a person free from dishonesty, a person free from revenge and violence. He knew he also had pictured a different kind of society where the power of domination of property was broken and there was equality, where there was a vital faith without hypocrisy. He knew he had done that. He knew he had pictured a colony of heaven on this sinful earth. He knew all about that. And he knew there'd be a mixture. He knew there would be the weak and the strong. He knew there would be the false and the true. He knew there'd be the faithful and the unfaithful. He knew there'd be people who wouldn't stick with it to the end. And he knew the church would have to deal with all of that. And so Matthew 7 tackles the challenging problems that need to be overcome if this is ever to be a reality. And like I said, I've always appreciated this chapter because it's realism. It's right where we live. So if you look at chapter 7, verses 1 to 12. I'll just read it. I noticed I haven't been reading my passages, so I'm just going to read this whole thing. Judge not, that you be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye mete, it shall be measured to you. Again. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye. Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then thou shalt see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. Give not that which is holy unto dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn again and rend you. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. Or what man is there of you, whom if his son ask bread, will give him a stone? Or if he ask a fish, will he give him a serpent? If ye then, being evil, know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your Father which is in heaven give good things to them that ask him? Therefore, all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do you even so to them. For this is the law and the prophets. Now this passage asks four questions. It asks, how should we give these ideals? How should we handle them in the brotherhood? How should we handle them with people out there? How should we have the wisdom to know how to apply all of this that we're going to talk about? And finally, what do we do in situations not covered by the Sermon on the Mount? What do we do about those situations? So those are the four questions we'll be asking. So the first one is, how do I relate Jesus' teachings to fellow Christians? Well, that's verses 1 through 5. And I would title this, Correct with Compassion. Okay? Now, the Anabaptists have been passionate about perfect churches. That's why we've had all these divisions through the years. We always launch out to do it again. We're going to do it right this time. And 30 years later, another group, we've been passionate about this ideal of an ideal community, even though maybe we didn't always understand the kingdom teaching, but we always put a lot of emphasis on a perfect church, and we really worked at it hard. Well, the unfortunate thing is Ephesians chapter 4 picture a church that builds up and builds up and builds up until it finally represents Jesus Christ in a beautiful way. But most of our experience is it starts on a high and goes down. Now, I don't know, maybe your experience is different, but most of my experience has been the exact opposite. There have been hundreds of intentional communities, especially during the hippie movement. There were many of them. They all got together. They loved each other so much that they said they could eat each other. And believe it or not, they actually tried to do that finally. And they all failed finally in the end. This is a beautiful ideal that ironically, if we don't know how to handle these things where Jesus talked about, it will turn into a nightmare. It'll be the exact opposite of what we intended. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. But if ye bite and devour one another, take heed that you be not consumed one of another. And we all know what that looks like. Jesus understood what we do not see. And so he says right here at the beginning, do not judge. Now that doesn't mean we're not supposed to discriminate. At the end of the passage, he talks about, as I said earlier, and we're not going to talk about the end of the passage, he says, look out for those who promote an undisciplined life. Enter in at the straight gate. Don't go in that broad gate. I spent most of my life trying to tell young people, beware of the undisciplined way. And that's the first thing he warns about at the end. So we need to discriminate those who are promoting an undisciplined way of life and not hear what they have to say or follow them. He also, at the end of the passage, talks about false prophetic personalities. They're the ones that go around with all these seminars that have everything packaged beautifully, and it's all wonderful till you look at their families and you see that they don't really live the wonderful theories they teach. Beware of those people that don't have any fruit for all of their efforts. And then there's that group that knows that there should be fruit, so then they produce miracles. They're the lawless miracle workers. They work miracles, but they don't obey. And then finally, avoid the foolish people who build on other teachings rather than Jesus' teaching. So those warnings are at the end. We are to discriminate, and yet here at the beginning he says don't condemn. What does he mean by the word condemn? Well, I think if we look at the word itself, we start to get a clue. It's condemn. I want you to look long and hard at this part of the word. Do you see what I see? How many see what I see? All right, I'll give you a clue. Change one letter. Change the vowel. Now do you see what I see? D-A-M-N. That's what Jesus says we don't do. What does it mean to damn? It means to put to the test, to sentence, to punish, to avenge, to give a final verdict, to put into an unredeemable category. And he says, don't do that. Don't condemn. It's the same word as Judges in Romans chapter 2, verse 1, where he says, who are you that condemns another person? If you do this, you do the same things. And it is very interesting that liars somehow have a special propensity of hearing other people who don't tell the truth and blaming them and condemning them. People who are immoral are pretty easy to sniff out other people who are immoral and put them down. It seems like if you have a weakness in your own heart, you tend to put other people down because it gives you the sort of the idea that you're raising yourself in the process, sort of a false exaltation. We all remember the TV evangelist years ago who had a sexual indiscretion, pretty serious. And there was another TV evangelist that got on the TV. I just scorched him alive, just roasted him alive, and just on and on and on and on. Only to be found out a year later he was doing the same thing. And I was in a barbershop of an atheist shortly after that, and that came on the screen, and he was making his confession, weeping and so on, and the barber just absolutely despised him. This is an ugly thing where we put other people down. Jesus never did that. Did you know that? The Bible says God sent not his son into the world to condemn the world. It's this word. Jesus never put people down. You say, well, what about Matthew 33? You vipers. Did you ever consider how that might have been said? You vipers. You hypocrites. With tears streaming down his cheeks, because at the end of the chapter, he's weeping over the city. We assume that he was really laying them out flat. I don't think so. I think Jesus said that with tears running down his cheeks, with a heart of real compassion for these people. So, anyway, it's an attempt to raise ourselves by putting others down. I call it the Haman syndrome. The problem is one word: self-righteousness. Self-righteousness. We judge ourselves to be right and them to be wrong, and we put them down. We are not here to put anybody down, ever. It's like I said, if you have to say something that's hurtful, you study carefully, like Jesus said we're supposed to study, and make sure that all the self-righteousness is scrubbed out of your heart. You know, when a surgeon is about to do surgery, especially on the eye is a very delicate part of, most delicate, it's interesting that Jesus chose that. They'll scrub and scrub and scrub for 20, 25 minutes with the best antibacterial agent that they can possibly get to make sure there is no pathogen entered into this operation. The pathogen that enters into human relationships is self-righteousness. And Jesus is saying, you make sure, don't you quit gazing. That word behold means to gaze at. Quit gazing at the fault. Gaze at your heart. See if you can get yourself in a position where you can go to the brother and you can honestly say, my only reason for going is because I want to reclaim him. I'm not in any way trying to put him down. I'm not in any way to make him feel like he's being judged by me. Maybe judged by the words that are said, but not by me. That I have a heart of compassion. And what Jesus is saying is, until you are able to do that, just don't bother to go. You'll cause more trouble than what you will ever accomplish. So I have several reasons why this is wrong. Number one, it is the opposite of what Jesus did. He did not come into the world to condemn the world. In fact, he had to tell his disciples on several occasions, your desire to have these people experience the wrath of God, call down fire from heaven, you're wrong. I didn't come here to destroy life. I came here to save life. In fact, Jesus' own judgment, even at the end, will not be personal condemnation. Let me read this. And if any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not. For I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one that judgeth him. The word that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. So even in the last day, Jesus will not be judging anybody. It'll be his words that judge. In a personal way, Jesus will not be giving any personal condemnation to anybody. The second point. So first of all, it's the opposite of what Jesus did. Secondly, it causes us to project our faults on others, and I've already given you that, all right? And it carries a high risk of self-righteousness. Have you ever noticed when others are set in their ways, they're obstinate, but when you are, you're firm? When your neighbor doesn't like your friend, he's prejudiced. If you don't like his friend, you're a good judge of human nature. When he takes time to do things well, he's a slowpoke or lazy. When you do, you are deliberate and careful. When he is mild-mannered, you call him weak. And when you are mild-mannered, you call it graciousness. When someone dresses especially well, that person is extravagant. When you do, it is good taste. When he says what he thinks, he's spiteful. But when you do, you're just being frank. And that's the way we tend to relate to people if we're not careful. And finally, it misses the goal of correction, which is to win the brother. Okay? And that's what it should be. And if you can't go with that purpose, just don't bother to go. It's too many times when people went to condemn and said things that were hurtful and put people down and put them in a category and stepped up and stood on top of them. All of that behavior is the opposite of what Jesus did, and that's what he's warning us against here. Self-righteousness, if you don't remember anything else I said, self-righteousness is the problem. We need to take care of that. So what is the answer? Well, focus on your own repentance first, and it's very likely in any situation you're in, you think you're better than the other person. You think you know and they don't. You know all of that. In fact, the interesting illustration I like to give is the man who wrote a book on child training. And he wrote it before he had any children, or else his children were very small. The title of the book, the first time it came out, was 10 Surefire Ways to Raise Spiritual Giants. And I mean, he had all the answers in that book. He knew, and everybody else needed to be taught. 12 years later, the book was out of print. He had children, 10, 15, 12 years old. And so he revised the book, and he put it back in print again. And the second title was 10 Principles of Child Training. 12 years later, the book was out of print. His children were all gone from home. He revised the book. He put it back in print under the last title, A Few Child Training, Suggestions You Might Find Helpful. That's the stage I'm in. If you want the best messages on child training, get the ones I did before I was married or shortly afterward. You'll have all the answers right there. But there was an attitude there if you listened to them. And I knew, and everybody else needed to be taught. And that we just need to deal with that. It's just a major problem. So focus on your own repentance first. Cleanse out the hypocrisy. It's easy to act concerned when you're not really. Gossip gives us status. It gives us the idea we are better than somebody else, okay? And once you have gotten all the pathogens of self-righteousness out of your heart, then go and correct your brother, okay? Self-righteousness sees the mote. The clean heart sees how to remove it. And there's a big difference. Okay. Our brothers are precious. That brother might be the very brother that I need someday for a need in my own life. And if I get rid of him, he won't be there when I need him. A few cautions. Greed, jealousy, hatred, hurts are contagious. Avoid people who are always talking about these things, always gossiping, always talking about it. Somebody said gossip is that which goes in both ears and comes out the mouth greatly enlarged. Stay away from those people, okay? Fight against gossip. Develop a readiness to compliment. I had a friend who was a student at Eastern Mennonite College in its early years, and M.T. Brackville was the famous astronomer there. He built the telescope there up on the hill. His wife was Mrs. M.T. Brackville. She taught literature, and I had a friend who was in her class at EMC, and he said that he never met anybody who could compliment people like she could. She never let an opportunity passed to compliment a student on an answer they gave, to get up and read a paper she thought was well done, compliment, whatever she could do. She just was always complimenting. He said once in a while she was absent and had to have a substitute teacher. And he said we were even on better behavior with the substitute teacher than we were with her, because the worst thing that could happen was to have Miss M.T. Brackbell come back and hear that we had misbehaved. That's the kind of relationships we should be cultivating. Relationships where we compliment. We're so afraid we're going to make somebody proud. We don't mind too much if we put people down. We should be complimenting. We should be building people up. So that's the first thing that Jesus has to say here. How do we relate this to the brotherhood? Correct with compassion. There will need to be correction. That will need to happen. But you make sure your heart has been scrubbed of all self-righteousness. You're going to do a very delicate eye operation. Don't introduce the pathogen of self-righteousness into that surgery. The second question is, how do I relate this to people out there? Well, we need to be careful, because to the people out there, these gospel ideals make no sense at all. If I say on the billboard line to someone that fornication is wrong, they immediately say, what? What's that? Well, then I describe it. Well, that's what dating's all about. And, oh, they think that's just ridiculous to talk about purity and courtship. Or if I talk about non-accumulation of wealth, how much sense does that make to those people out there? Or if I talk about turning the other cheek, those things make no sense to those people out there. We have to learn how to relate these teachings in a way that they don't just react and turn us off and never hear what we have to say. I had that happen. The first night after we were married, the next Sunday morning, we were married on Saturday, we got up and went to the largest church, I guess, in Winchester. At least it seemed to have the tallest steeple. And we went at 9 o'clock. We were too uninformed to know that most people don't start church at 1 o'clock, 9 o'clock. But the pastor was having early morning Bible study with a very special little group of people. And believe it or not, they were studying the Ten Commandments, and the commandment they were studying that Sunday morning was, thou shalt not kill. And here I was. So he stood up and he said, now he said, the majority understanding of the gospel is it's right to kill under certain circumstances, and he gave the just war theory. He said, now that's the majority opinion or interpretation. Now he said, there's always been a very small minority, I'm sure we don't have one represented here today, who believe it's wrong to kill under all circumstances. So I waited until it got to the right place in the discussion. I raised my hand and said, I represent that small minority. Oh, we're so glad to have you here. We want to hear this position. And they started to ask questions, but it didn't last long. They soon were disgusted with my answers and went back to their majority opinion. So you have to be, I think if I were in that discussion now, I could maybe have some wisdom as to how I could say some things that would at least keep their hearts open enough to hear. So what he's saying is be very careful how you handle these teachings with people out there. If you teach Kingdom of God principles of equal sharing, well, there was a man by the name of Karl Marx took that one time. And created a disaster in which 100 million people perished. It actually was a gospel heresy, the way he practiced it. And so we have to really be careful. These principles, if applied by people who don't have the grace of God and the wisdom of God, can actually create an awful lot of harm. And he says they'll turn and rend you. This will be vicious if we don't get this right. Well, you say, well, then how do we do this? We're supposed to witness to those people. Well, Jesus said it back earlier in the Sermon on the Mount. Let your light so shine before men. You see, we can hear and then obey and show. With the world, it's show and tell. They have to see it. Even on the day of Pentecost, that sermon didn't get preached until there was a supernatural phenomenon, and then the people said, what is this? And their ears were open, and Peter preached the message. I told you this morning that nickel mines, when that hit the news, it was front page news all over the world. This was amazing. It was a time for non-resistant people to preach the message because the world was listening. And so the world has to see before they hear. Supernatural phenomenon. Now, when I'm on the telephone talking to people who call from the billboards, I don't have much to show. They don't see me. But what I can do is I can be as kind and loving as possible so they at least have heard and felt a little bit of the gospel across the telephone. In fact, the highest compliment they ever pay is when they say, when I saw that sign, I thought I was going to get an angry fundamentalist on the phone and we would have a good argument. And you surprised me and I enjoyed this conversation and I have some things to think about. That always blesses me. I feel like I have made some progress when I hear that. So the idea is to show them, present something that they can feel or see, and then present the message from there. Well, How do you perceive all of this? How do you know how to make all these decisions? Well, the next thing he says is ask, seek, knock. And he promises that if you keep knocking, you keep seeking. The ETH, those of you who weren't here, in the King James language, usually, not always, usually means continual seeking, continual asking, continual knocking. If you are persistent, you will get answers. It's a little bit like the philosopher who had a young fellow come to him and said, I perceive you're one of the wisest men I ever met. Would you tell me how to be wise? He said, sure, I can tell you that. They were standing on the beach, and he waded out into the deeper water, and the young man waded out until they were up to about here, and then he pushed his head under the water and held it there for a long time until the fellow was in pretty bad shape. And then he let him up. He said, now, what did you think about when your head was under the water? Did you think about how much money you were making? Did you think about your vacation? Did you think about your retirement? No. What did you think about? Air. Well, when you want wisdom as badly as you wanted air, you will become wise. And that's what Jesus is saying. If you want answers, and you desperately want answers, you will ask, then you'll seek, which means adding effort to your asking. You go talk to people, you read the Bible, you get all the information you can possibly get, and you just keep searching and searching. And then knocking is persistence. You take that approach and you will get answers to your questions. God always gives us the best gifts. It says, everyone, this just hit me, I'm an old man. This just hit me about 5-6 years ago. It says, everyone that keeps on asking shall receive. I don't know if you have things on your prayer list that you've prayed for years, but you should. Just keep asking. And it's a promise that you will receive. It doesn't say you'll receive exactly what you ask, but you will receive what is needed in, on the basis of what you have asked. God will give you what you need. Well, the Bible says, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole world to show himself strong in behalf of those whose hearts are perfect toward him. And so as we keep begging and asking and demonstrating our desire to know and obey, God reveals himself to us. And finally, how shall I conduct myself in situations not covered by these teachings? The Sermon on the Mount is extremely brief. I told you it's half the length of the Constitution of the United States. If you take it down to chapter 6, it's even shorter. And yet it's the Constitution for a universal kingdom through all time and eternity. So what do you do if you get up against something that's not addressed here? Well, the Constitution of the United States has an interesting clause. It's called the Commerce Clause. And that says the United States government has the authority to address any issue that has to do with interstate commerce. But sometimes there are things come up that has to do with the whole United States that don't fit under that clause, those statements that the federal government has the power to do. And so the Commerce Clause says, if there's anything that needs to be dealt with in relation to the whole nation that's not mentioned here, the Congress has the authority to deal with it. It's called the Expansion Clause. Well, this has an expansion clause. It says, as ye would that men should do to you, do you also to them. That covers everything. That's the expansion clause. But it's an interesting expansion clause. If I had been looking for something that every person would have a reference point they could appeal to, I'd have looked for something good in every person. I'd have said, now here's a good trait that you have. You put that to practice. But Jesus chose our selfishness. He chose the worst part of us as the reference point. That means then that there won't be anybody who doesn't have that reference point. Everybody will have it. And this is how it goes. You think the selfish thought, the most selfish thoughts you can think, and then go do that to the other person. Can anybody think who in the Bible was the best example of this? I think I heard it. I heard it over here. Haman. What shall be done to the man the king delights to honor? Well, that must be me. put the crown on his head, get the robe out, get him on the horse, have somebody lead him down through the streets. This is the man in whom the king delights to honor. And Haman thought, boy, this is really good. The king said, Haman, I think that's a good suggestion. Go do that to Mordecai. That's what this says. This is a chance when you can indulge your selfishness. Indulge it to the fullest, and then go do it to the other person, and you will always be right. I think that's genius. So, this enlists our selfishness in the service of love. Isn't that a beautiful paradox? No one can ever say, I don't have a place to start. I don't know where to begin with this decision. Yeah, you do. Start with your selfishness. Start to indulge it and then go use it. God says, my strength is made perfect in weakness. This is an example. Surely the wrath of men shall praise thee. This is an example. God chooses the base things of this world. This is an example. This is selfishness turned on its head to fulfill all that's in the law and the prophets. Gospel ideals are attainable if we take this approach. Let's learn to relate the gospel to all men, to people in the brotherhood, but getting rid of self-righteousness, to people out there by realizing that we have to be careful how we relate. You know, the Bible tells us there are three groups of people out there. There's the simple, there's the scorner, there's the simple, there's the fool, and there's the scorner. The simple person is the person who believes everything you say. It's the deacon who somebody came to him and told him something, and he said, I think you're right. The next day, somebody came who had the opposite view, and he said, I think you're right. And his wife said, honey, they can't both be right. And he said, you're right, honey. So that's the simple person, okay? The fool has already made up his mind. He knows, and he's rejected. There's a little bit of hope for him. The scorner is the person who's made up his mind and not only has made up his mind to reject it, but to destroy the message and the messenger. Those are the people you have to be aware of. The Bible gives them almost no hope at all, and there's no point in even almost trying to witness to them. If you show, maybe you can get their attention. Let's not defeat our kingdom ideals by behaviors that defeat our message. That's what I conclude this message with. And I didn't see anybody naughty, or not very many anyway. I conclude with a story. I'll read it. There was once a famous German artist by the name of Herkimer, born in the Black Forest, whose father was a simple woodchopper. Herkimer was a gifted artist, and as his reputation grew, he moved to London and built a studio there. He sent for his aged father, and his dad came, full of pride for his son, and lived with him. The old man enjoyed creating things out of clay, and he learned to make very beautiful bowls and vases, items of which he was very proud. So the father and the son were in business together as artisans. But as the years passed, the old man's abilities deteriorated, and at the end of the day, as he went upstairs, he would often seem sad because he felt that his work was now not good enough. Herkimer's sharp eyes detected this, and when his father was safely upstairs and asleep for the night, he would go downstairs, pick up the green pottery, put it back on the wheel, and correct the blemishes. His father would come down in the morning, he would hold up the pieces to the light, and he would smile and say, I can still do as well as I once did. We're here to put the brother back on the wheel and to perfect the blemishes. And if we take this message seriously and correct with compassion, witness with wisdom, perceive with prayer, and serve with self-sacrifice, we can, in fact, present to the world this beautiful ideal, and we can show wondrous beauty wrapped around trouble. Shall we bow our heads for prayer?